and all else has drowned, is drowning, or will drown. It will be enormous, the book. There will be oceans of space in which to move about, to perambulate, to sing, to dance, to climb, to bathe, to leap, somersaults, to whine, to rape, to murder. A cathedral, a veritable cathedral, in the building of which everybody will assist who has lost his identity. There will be masses for the dead, prayers, confessions, hymns, a moaning and a chattering, a sort of murderous insouciance. There will be rose windows and gargoyles and acolytes and pallbearers. You can bring your horses in and gallop through the aisles. You can butt your head against the walls. They won't give. You can pray in any language you choose, or you can curl up outside and go to sleep. It will last 1,000 years at least, this cathedral, and there will be no replica, for the builders will be dead, and the formula, too. We will have postcards made and organize tours. We will build a town around it and set up a free commune. We have no need for genius. Genius is dead. We have need for strong hands, for spirits who are willing to give up the ghost and put on flesh. The day is moving along at a fine tempo. I am up on the balcony at Tanya's place. The drama is going on down below in the drawing room. The dramatist is sick, and from above, his scalp looks more scabrous than ever. His hair is made of straw. His ideas are straw. His wife, too, is straw, though still a little damp. The whole house is made of straw. Here I am up on the balcony waiting for Boris to arrive. My last problem, breakfast, is gone. I have simplified everything. If there are any new problems, I can carry them in my rucksack, along with my dirty wash. I am throwing away all my sous. What need have I for money? I am a writing machine. The last screw has been added. The thing flows. Between me and the machine, there is no estrangement. I am the machine. They have not told me yet what the new drama is about, but I can sense it. They are trying to get rid of me. Yet here I am for my dinner, even a little earlier than they expected. I have informed them where to sit, what to do. I ask them politely if I shall be disturbing them. But what I really mean, and they know it well, is, will you be disturbing me? No, you blissful cockroaches, you are not disturbing me. You are nourishing me. I see you sitting there close together, and I know there is a chasm between you. Your nearness is the nearness of planets. I am the void between you. If I withdraw, there will be no void for you to swim in. Tanya is in a hostile mood. I can feel it. She resents my being filled with anything but herself. She knows by the very caliber of my excitement that her value is reduced to zero. She knows that I did not come this evening to fertilize her. She knows there is something germinating inside me which will destroy her. She is slow to realize, but she is realizing it. Sylvester looks more content. He will embrace her this evening at the dinner table. Even now he is reading my manuscript, preparing to inflame my ego, to set my ego against hers. It will be a strange gathering this evening. The stage is being set. I hear the tinkle of the glasses. The wine is being brought out. There will be bumpers downed, and Sylvester, who is ill, will come out of his illness. It was only last night at Kronstadt's that we projected this setting. It was ordained that the women must suffer, that offstage there should be more terror and violence, more disasters, more suffering, more woe and misery. It is no accident that propels people like us to Paris. Paris is simply an artificial stage, a revolving stage that permits the spectator to glimpse all phases of the conflict. Of itself, Paris initiates no dramas. They are begun elsewhere. Paris is simply an obstetrical instrument that tears the living embryo from the womb and puts it in the incubator. Paris is the cradle of artificial births. Rocking here in the cradle, each one slips back into his soil. One dreams back to Berlin, New York, Chicago, Vienna, Minsk. Vienna is never more Vienna than in Paris. Everything is raised to apotheosis. The cradle gives up its babes, and new ones take their places. You can read here on the walls where Zola lived, and Balzac, and Dante, and Strindberg, and everybody who ever was anything. Everyone has lived here sometime or other. Nobody dies here. They are talking downstairs. Their language is symbolic. The word struggle enters into it. Sylvester, the sick dramatist, is saying, "I am just reading the manifesto." And Tanya says, "Whose?" "Yes, Tanya, I heard you. I am up here writing about you, and you divine it well. Speak more, that I may record you. For when we go to the table, I shall not be able to make any notes." Suddenly, Tanya remarks, "There is no prominent hall in this place." Now, what does that mean, if anything? They are putting up pictures now. That, too, is to impress me. "See," they wish to say, "we are at home here, living the conjugal life, making the home attractive. We will even argue a little about the pictures for your benefit." And Tanya remarks again, "How the eye deceives one." "Ah, Tanya, what things you say. Go on, carry out this farce a little longer. I am here to get the dinner you promised me. I enjoy this comedy tremendously." And now Sylvester takes the lead. He is trying to explain one of Borowski's gouache. "Come here, do you see? One of them is playing the guitar. The other is holding a girl in his lap." True, Sylvester, very true. Borowski and his guitars. The girls in his lap. Only one never quite knows what it is he holds in his lap, or whether it is really a man playing the guitar. Soon Waldorf will be trotting in on all fours and Boris with that helpless little laugh of his. There will be a golden pheasant for dinner, an Anjou and short fat cigars, and Kronstadt, when he gets the latest news, will live a little harder, a little brighter, for 5 minutes. And then he will subside again into the humus of his ideology, and perhaps a poem will be born, a big golden bell of a poem without a tongue. Had to knock off for an hour or so. Another customer to look at the apartment. Upstairs, the bloody Englishman is practicing his Bach. It is imperative now, when someone comes to look at the apartment, to run upstairs and ask the pianist to lay off for a while. Elsa is telephoning the greengrocer. The plumber is putting a new seat on the toilet bowl. Whenever the doorbell rings, Boris loses his equilibrium. In the excitement, he has dropped his glasses. He is on his hands and knees. His frock coat is dragging the floor. It is a little like the Grand Guignol, the starving poet come to give the butcher's daughter lessons. Every time the phone rings, the poet's mouth waters. Mallarmé sounds like a sirloin steak. Victor Hugo like foie de veau. Elsa is ordering a delicate little lunch for Boris. "A nice, juicy little pork chop," she says. I see a whole flock of pink hams lying cold on the marble. Wonderful hams cushioned in white fat. I have a terrific hunger, though we've only had breakfast a few minutes ago. It's the lunch that I'll have to skip. It's only Wednesdays that I eat lunch, thanks to Borowski. Elsa is still telephoning. She forgot to order a piece of bacon. "Yes, a nice little piece of bacon, not too fatty," she says. "Zut alors. Throw in some sweet breads. Throw in some mountain oysters and some, clams. Throw in some fried liverwurst while you're at it. I could gobble up the 1,500 plays of Lope de Vega in one sitting." It is a beautiful woman who has come to look at the apartment. An American, of course. I stand at the window with my back to her, watching a sparrow pecking at a fresh turd. Amazing how easily the sparrow is provided for. It is raining a bit, and the drops are very big. I used to think a bird couldn't fly if its wings got wet. Amazing how these rich dames come to Paris and find all the swell studios. A little talent and a big purse. If it rains, they have a chance to display their brand new slickers. Food is nothing. Sometimes they're so busy gadding about that they haven't time for lunch. Just a little sandwich, a wafer, at the Café de la Paix or the Ritz Bar. For the daughters of gentlefolk only. That's what it says at the old studio of Pouvy de Chavannes. Happened to pass there the other day. Rich American cunts with paint boxes slung over their shoulders. A little talent and a fat purse. The sparrow is hopping frantically from one cobblestone to another. Truly Herculean efforts, if you stop to examine closely. Everywhere there is food lying about. In the gutter, I mean. The beautiful American woman is inquiring about the toilet. The toilet? Let me show you, you velvet-snooted gazelle. The toilet, you say? Par ici, madame. N'oubliez pas que les places numérotées sont réservées aux mutilés de la guerre. Boris is rubbing his hands. He is putting the finishing touches to the deal. The dogs are barking in the courtyard. They bark like wolves. Upstairs, Mrs. Melvinesse is moving the furniture around. She had nothing to do all day. She's bored. If she finds a crumb of dirt anywhere, she cleans the whole house. There's a bunch of green grapes on the table and a bottle of wine. Vin de choix, 10 degrees. Yes, says Boris. I could make a washstand for you. Just come here, please. Yes, this is the toilet. There is one upstairs, too, of course. Yes, 1,000 francs a month. You don't care much for you trio, you say? No, this is it. It needs a new washer, that's all. She's going in a minute now. Boris hasn't even introduced me this time, the son of a bitch. Whenever it's a rich cunt, he forgets to introduce me. In a few minutes, I'll be able to sit down again and type. Somehow, I don't feel like it anymore today. My spirit is dribbling away. She may come back in an hour or so and take the chair from under my ass. How the hell can a man write when he doesn't know where he's going to sit the next half hour? If this rich bastard takes the place, I won't even have a place to sleep. It's hard to know when you're in such a jam, which is worse, not having a place to sleep or not having a place to work. One can sleep almost anywhere, but one must have a place to work, even if it's not a masterpiece you're doing. Even a bad novel requires a chair to sit on and a bit of privacy. These rich cunts never think of a thing like that. Whenever they want to lower their soft behinds, there's always a chair standing ready for them. Last night, we left Sylvester and his god sitting together before the hearth. Sylvester in his pajamas, Maldorf with a cigar between his lips. Sylvester is peeling an orange. He puts the peel on the couch cover. Maldorf draws closer to him. He asks permission to read again that brilliant parody, The Gates of Heaven. We are getting ready to go, Boris and I. We are too gay for this sickroom atmosphere. Tanya is going with us. She is gay because she is going to escape. Boris is gay because the god in Maldorf is dead. I am gay because it is another act we are going to put on. Maldorf's voice is reverent. Can I stay with you, Sylvester, until you go to bed? He has been staying with him for the last 6 days, buying medicine, running errands for Tanya, comforting, consoling, guarding the portals against malevolent intruders like Boris and his scalawags. He is like a savage who has discovered that his idol was mutilated during the night. There he sits at the idol's feet with breadfruit and grease and jabberwocky prayers. His voice goes out unctuously. His limbs are already paralyzed. To Tanya, he speaks as if she were a priestess who had broken her vows. You must make yourself worthy. Sylvester is your god. And while Sylvester is upstairs suffering, he has a little wheeze in the chest. The priest and the priestess devour the food. You are polluting yourself, he says, the gravy dripping from his lips. He has the capacity for eating and suffering at the same time. While he fends off the dangerous ones, he puts out his fat little paw and strokes Tanya's hair. I'm beginning to fall in love with you. You are like my Fanny. In other respects, it has been a fine day for Maldorf. A letter arrived from America. Mo is getting A's in everything. Murray is learning to ride the bicycle. The Victrola was repaired. You can see from the expression on his face that there were other things in the letter besides report cards and velocipedes. You can be sure of it because this afternoon he bought 325 francs worth of jewelry for his Fanny. In addition, he wrote her a 20-page letter. The garçon brought him page after page, filled his fountain pen, served his coffee and cigars, fanned him a little when he perspired, brushed the crumbs from the table, lit his cigar when it went out, bought stamps for him, danced on him, pirouetted, salaamed, broke his spine damn near. The tip was fat, bigger and fatter than a Corona Corona. Moldov probably mentioned it in his diary. It was for Fanny's sake. The bracelet and the earrings, they were worth every sou he spent. Better to spend it on Fanny than waste it on little strumpets like Germaine and Odette. Yes, he told Tanya so. He showed her his trunk. It is crammed with gifts for Fanny and for Mo and Murray. My Fanny is the most intelligent woman in the world. I have been searching and searching to find a flaw in her, but there's not one. She's perfect. I'll tell you what Fanny can do. She plays bridge like a shark. She's interested in Zionism. You give her an old hat, for instance, and see what she can do with it. A little twist here, a ribbon there, and voila, quelque chose de beau. Do you know what is perfect bliss? To sit beside Fanny when Mo and Murray have gone to bed and listen to the radio. She sits there so peacefully. I am rewarded for all my struggles and heartaches in just watching her. She listens intelligently. When I think of your stinking Montparnasse, and then of my evenings in Bay Ridge with Fanny after a big meal, I tell you there is no comparison. A simple thing like food, the children, the soft lamps, and Fanny sitting there, a little tired but cheerful, contented, heavy with bread. We just sit there for hours without saying a word. That's bliss. Today she writes me a letter. Not one of those dull stock report letters. She writes me from the heart, in a language that even my little Murray could understand. She's delicate about everything, Fanny. She says that the children must continue their education, but the expense worries her. It will cost $1,000 to send little Murray to school. Mo, of course, will get a scholarship. But little Murray, that little genius Murray, what are we going to do about him? I wrote to Fanny not to worry. Send Murray to school, I said. What's another $1,000? I'll make more money this year than ever before. I'll do it for little Murray, because he's a genius, that kid. I should like to be there when Fanny opens the trunk. See, Fanny, this is what I bought in Budapest from an old Jew. This is what they wear in Bulgaria. It's pure wool. This belonged to the Duke of something or other. No, you don't wind it. You put it in the sun. This I want you to wear, Fanny, when we go to the opera. Wear it with that comb I showed you. And this, Fanny, is something Tanya picked up for me. She's a little bit on your type. And Fanny is sitting there on the settee, just as she was in the oleograph, with Mo on one side of her and little Murray, Murray the genius, on the other. Her fat legs are a little too short to reach the floor. Her eyes have a dull permanganate glow. Breasts like ripe red cabbage. They bobble a little when she leans forward. But the sad thing about her is that the juice has been cut off. She sits there like a dead storage battery. Her face is out of plumb. It needs a little animation, a sudden spurt of juice to bring it back into focus. Maldorf is jumping around in front of her like a fat toad. His flesh quivers. He slips, and it is difficult for him to roll over again on his belly. She prods him with her thick toes. Her eyes protrude a little further. Kick me again, Fanny. That was good. She gives him a good prod this time. It leaves a permanent dent in his paunch. His face is close to the carpet. The wattles are joggling in the nape of the rug. He livens up a bit, flips around, springs from furniture to furniture. Fanny, you are marvelous. He is sitting now on her shoulder. He bites a little piece from her ear, just a little tip from the lobe where it doesn't hurt. But she's still dead. All storage battery and no juice. He falls on her lap and lies there quivering like a toothache. He is all warm now and helpless. His belly glistens like a patent leather shoe. In the sockets of his eyes, a pair of fancy vest buttons. Unbutton my eyes, Fanny. I want to see you better. Fanny carries him to bed and drops a little hot wax over his eyes. She puts rings around his navel and a thermometer up his ass. She places him, and he quivers again. Suddenly, he's dwindled, shrunk completely out of sight. She searches all over for him, in her intestines, everywhere. Something is tickling her. She doesn't know where exactly. The bed is full of toads and fancy vest buttons. Fanny, where are you? Something is tickling her. She can't say where. The buttons are dropping off the bed. The toads are climbing the walls, a tickling and a tickling. Fanny, take the wax out of my eyes. I want to look at you. But Fanny is laughing, squirming with laughter. There is something inside her, tickling and tickling. She'll die laughing if she doesn't find it. Fanny, the trunk is full of beautiful things. Fanny, do you hear me? Fanny is laughing, laughing like a fat worm. Her belly is swollen with laughter. Her legs are getting blue. Oh, God, Morris, there is something tickling me. I can't help it. Sunday. Left the Villa Borghese a little before noon, just as Boris was getting ready to sit down to lunch. I left out of a sense of delicacy, because it really pains Boris to see me sitting there in the studio with an empty belly. Why he doesn't invite me to lunch with him, I don't know. He says he can't afford it, but that's no excuse. Anyway, I'm delicate about it. If it pains him to eat alone in my presence, it would probably pain him more to share his meal with me. It's not my place to pry into his secret affairs. Dropped in at the Kronstadts, and they were eating too. A young chicken with wild rice. Pretended that I had eaten already, but I could have torn the chicken from the baby's hands. This is not just false modesty. It's a kind of perversion, I'm thinking. Twice they asked me if I wouldn't join them. No, no, wouldn't even accept a cup of coffee after the meal. I'm delicat, I am. On the way out, I cast a lingering glance at the bones lying on the baby's plate. There was still meat on them. Prowling around aimlessly. A beautiful day so far. The Rue de Bouquy is alive, crawling. Bars wide open and the curbs lined with bicycles. All the meat and vegetable markets are in full swing. Arms loaded with truck bandaged in newspapers. A fine Catholic Sunday, in the morning at least. High noon, and here I am standing on an empty belly at the confluence of all these crooked lanes that reek with the odor of food. Opposite me is the Hôtel de Louisiane, a grim old hostelry known to the bad boys of the Rue de Bouquy in the good old days. Hotels and food, and I'm walking about like a leper, with crabs gnawing at my entrails. On Sunday mornings, there's a fever in the streets. Nothing like it anywhere, except perhaps on the east side, or down around Chatham Square. The Rue de l'Échaudet is seething. The streets twist and turn, at every angle a fresh hive of activity. Long queues of people with vegetables under their arms, turning in here and there with crisp, sparkling appetites. Nothing but food, food, food. Makes one delirious. Past the square to Fürstenberg. Looks different now at high noon. The other night when I passed by, it was deserted, bleak, spectral. In the middle of the square, four black trees that have not yet begun to blossom. Intellectual trees, nourished by the paving stones. Like T.S. Eliot's verse. Here, by God, if Marie Laurencin ever brought her lesbians out into the open, would be the place for them to commune. Très lesbienne ici. Sterile, hybrid, dry as Boris' heart. End of side two. Side 3. In the little garden adjoining the Église Saint-Germain are a few dismounted gargoyles, monsters that jut forward with a terrifying plunge. On the benches, other monsters, old people, idiots, cripples, epileptics, snoozing there quietly waiting for the dinner bell to ring. At the Galerie Zach across the way, some imbecile has made a picture of the cosmos on the flat, a painter's cosmos full of odds and ends bric-a-brac. In the lower left-hand corner, however, there's an anchor and a dinner bell. Salute, salute, O cosmos. Still prowling around, mid-afternoon, guts rattling, beginning to rain now. Notre Dame rises tomb-like from the water. The gargoyles lean far out over the lace facade. They hang there like an idée fixe in the mind of a monomaniac. An old man with yellow whiskers approaches me, has some Jaworski nonsense in his hand, comes up to me with his head thrown back, and the rain splashing in his face turns the golden sands to mud. Bookstore, with some of Raoul Dufy's drawings in the window. Drawings of charwomen with rose bushes between their legs. A treatise on the philosophy of Juan Miró. The philosophy, mind you. In the same window, A Man Cut in Slices. Chapter 1, The Man in the Eyes of His Family. Chapter 2, The Same in the Eyes of His Mistress. Chapter 3, No Chapter 3. Have to come back tomorrow for chapters 3 and 4. Every day the window trimmer turns a fresh page. A man cut in slices. You can't imagine how furious I am not to have thought of a title like that. Where is this bloke who writes the same in the eyes of his mistress, the same in the eyes of... the same... Where is this guy? Who is he? I want to hug him. I wish to Christ I had had brains enough to think of a title like that. Instead of Crazy Cock and the other fool things I invented? Well, fuck a duck. I congratulate him just the same. I wish him luck with his fine title. Here's another slice for you, for your next book. Ring me up someday. I'm living at the Villa Borghese. We're all dead or dying or about to die. We need good titles. We need meat. Slices and slices of meat. Juicy tenderloins. Porterhouse steaks. Kidneys, mountain oysters, sweetbreads. Someday when I'm standing at the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway, I'm going to remember this title, and I'm going to put down everything that goes on in my noodle. Caviar, raindrops, axle grease, vermicelli, livervoist, slices and slices of it. And I'll tell no one why, after I put everything down, I suddenly went home and chopped the baby to pieces. Un acte gratuit pour vous, cher monsieur, si bien coupé en tranches. How a man can wander about all day on an empty belly and even get an erection once in a while is one of those mysteries which are too easily explained by the anatomists of the soul. On a Sunday afternoon, when the shutters are down and the proletariat possesses the street in a kind of dumb torpor, there are certain thoroughfares which remind one of nothing less than a big, chancrous cock laid open longitudinally. And it is just these highways, the Rue Saint-Denis, for instance, or the Faubourg du Temple, which attract one irresistibly, much as in the old days around Union Square or the upper reaches of the Bowery, one was drawn to the dime museums, where in the show windows there were displayed wax reproductions of various organs of the body eaten away by syphilis and other venereal diseases. The city sprouts out like a huge organism, diseased in every part. The beautiful thoroughfares only a little less repulsive because they have been drained of their pus. At the Cité Nautier, somewhere near the Place du Combat, I pause a few minutes to drink in the full squalor of the scene. It is a rectangular court like many another which one glimpses through the low passageways that flank the old arteries of Paris. In the middle of the court is a clump of decrepit buildings which have so rotted away that they have collapsed on one another and formed a sort of intestinal embrace. The ground is uneven, the flagging slippery with slime, a sort of human dump heap which has been filled in with cinders and dry garbage. The sun is setting fast. The colors die. They shift from purple to dried blood, from nacre to bistre, from cool dead grays to pigeon shit. Here and there, a lopsided monster stands in the window, blinking like an owl. There is the shrill squawk of children with pale faces and bony limbs, rickety little urchins marked with the forceps. A fetid odor seeps from the walls, the odor of a mildewed mattress. Europe. Medieval, grotesque, monstrous. A symphony in B-moll. Directly across the street, the Ciné Combat offers its distinguished clientele, Metropolis. Coming away, my mind reverts to a book that I was reading only the other day. The town was a shambles. Corpses mangled by butchers and stripped by plunderers lay thick in the streets. Wolves sneaked from the suburbs to eat them. The Black Death and other plagues crept in to keep them company, and the English came marching on. The while the danse macabre whirled about the tombs in all the cemeteries. Paris, during the days of Charles the Silly. A lovely book, refreshing, appetizing. I'm still enchanted by it. About the patrons and prodromes of the Renaissance, I know little. But Madame Pimpernel, La Belle Boulangère, and Maître Johann Crapaud, L'Orfèvre, these occupy my spare thoughts still. Not forgetting Rodin, the evil genius of the wandering Jew who practiced his nefarious ways until the day when he was inflamed and outwitted by the octoroon Cecily. Sitting in the Square du Temple, musing over the doings of the horse-knackers, led by Jean Caboche, I have thought long and ruefully over the sad fate of Charles the Silly, a half-wit who prowled about the halls of his Hotel Saint-Paul, garbed in the filthiest rags, eaten away by ulcers and vermin, gnawing a bone when they flung him one, like a mangy dog. At the Rue des Lions, I looked for the stones of the old menagerie where he once fed his pets. His only diversion, poor dolt, aside from those card games with his low-born companion, Odette de Chandivert. It was a Sunday afternoon, much like this, when I first met Germaine. I was strolling along the Boulevard Beaumarchais, rich by 100 francs or so, which my wife had frantically cabled from America. There was a touch of spring in the air, a poisonous, malefic spring that seemed to burst from the manholes. Night after night, I had been coming back to this quarter, attracted by certain leprous streets which only revealed their sinister splendor when the light of day had oozed away and the whores commenced to take up their posts. The Rue du Pasteur Wagner is one I recall in particular, corner of the Rue Amelot, which hides behind the boulevard like a slumbering lizard. Here, at the neck of the bottle, so to speak, there was always a cluster of vultures who croaked and flapped their dirty wings, who reached out with sharp talons and plucked you into a doorway. Jolly rapacious devils who didn't even give you time to button your pants when it was over, led you into a little room off the street, a room without a window usually, and, sitting on the edge of the bed with skirts tucked up, gave you a quick inspection, spat on your cock, and placed it for you. While you washed yourself, another one stood at the door, and, holding her victim by the hand, watched nonchalantly as you gave the finishing touches to your toilette. Germaine was different. There was nothing to tell me so from her appearance, nothing to distinguish her from the other trollops who met each afternoon and evening at the Café de l'Elephant. As I say, it was a spring day, and the few francs my wife had scraped up to cable me were jingling in my pocket. I had a sort of vague premonition that I would not reach the Bastille without being taken in tow by one of these buzzards. Sauntering along the boulevard, I had noticed her verging toward me with that curious trotabout air of a whore and the run-down heels and cheap jewelry and the pasty look of their kind which the rouge only accentuates. It was not difficult to come to terms with her. We sat in the back of the little tabac called L'Elephant and talked it over quickly. In a few minutes, we were in a 5-franc room on the Rue Amelot, the curtains drawn and the covers thrown back. She didn't rush things, Germaine. She sat on the bidet, soaping herself, and talked to me pleasantly about this and that. She liked the knickerbockers I was wearing. Très chic, she thought. They were once, but I had worn the seat out of them. Fortunately, the jacket covered my ass. As she stood up to dry herself, still talking to me pleasantly, suddenly she dropped the towel and, advancing toward me leisurely, she commenced rubbing her pussy affectionately, stroking it with her two hands, caressing it, patting it, patting it. There was something about her eloquence at that moment and the way she thrust that rose bush under my nose, which remains unforgettable. She spoke of it as if it were some extraneous object which she had acquired at great cost, an object whose value had increased with time, and which now she prized above everything in the world. Her words imbued it with a peculiar fragrance. It was no longer just her private organ, but a treasure, a magic, potent treasure, a God-given thing, and nonetheless so because she traded it day in and day out for a few pieces of silver. As she flung herself on the bed, with legs spread wide apart, she cupped it with her hands and stroked it some more, murmuring all the while in that hoarse, cracked voice of hers that it was good, beautiful, a treasure, a little treasure. And it was good, that little pussy of hers. That Sunday afternoon, with its poisonous breath of spring in the air, everything clicked again. As we stepped out of the hotel, I looked her over again in the harsh light of day, and I saw clearly what a whore she was. The gold teeth, the geranium in her hat, the run-down heels, etc., etc. Even the fact that she had wormed a dinner out of me, and cigarettes and taxi, hadn't the least disturbing effect upon me. I encouraged it, in fact. I liked her so well that after dinner, we went back to the hotel again and took another shot at it. For love, this time. And again, that big bushy thing of hers worked its bloom and magic. It began to have an independent existence for me, too. There was Germaine, and there was that rosebush of hers. I liked them separately, and I liked them together. As I say, she was different, Germaine. Later, when she discovered my true circumstances, she treated me nobly, blew me to drinks, gave me credit, pawned my things, introduced me to her friends, and so on. She even apologized for not lending me money, which I understood quite well after her macareur had been pointed out to me. Night after night, I walked down the Boulevard Beaumarchais to the little tabac where they all congregated, and I waited for her to stroll in and give me a few minutes of her precious time. When, sometime later, I came to write about Claude, it was not Claude that I was thinking of, but Germaine. All the men she's been with, and now you, just you, and barges going by, masts and hulls, the whole damned current of life flowing through you, through her, through all the guys behind you and after you, the flowers and the birds and the sun streaming in and the fragrance of it choking you, annihilating you. That was for Germaine. Claude was not the same, though I admired her tremendously. I even thought for a while that I loved her. Claude had a soul and a conscience. She had refinement, too, which is bad in a whore. Claude always imparted a feeling of sadness. She left the impression, unwittingly, of course, that you were just one more added to the stream which fate had ordained to destroy her. Unwittingly, I say, because Claude was the last person in the world who would consciously create such an image in one's mind. She was too delicate, too sensitive for that. At bottom, Claude was just a good French girl of average breed and intelligence whom life had tricked somehow. Something in her there was which was not tough enough to withstand the shock of daily experience. For her were meant those terrible words of Louis Philippe. And a night comes when all is over, when so many jaws have closed upon us that we no longer have the strength to stand, and our meat hangs upon our bodies as though it had been masticated by every mouth. Germaine, on the other hand, was a whore from the cradle. She was thoroughly satisfied with her role, enjoyed it, in fact, except when her stomach pinched or her shoes gave out, little surface things of no account, nothing that ate into her soul, nothing that created torment. Ennui, That was the worst she ever felt. Days there were, no doubt, when she had a belly full, as we say, but no more than that. Most of the time, she enjoyed it, or gave the illusion of enjoying it. It made a difference, of course, whom she went with, or came with, but the principal thing was a man. A man. That was what she craved. A man with something between his legs that could tickle her, that could make her writhe in ecstasy, make her grab that bushy twat of hers with both hands and rub it joyfully, boastfully, proudly, with a sense of connection, a sense of life. That was the only place where she experienced any life, down there where she clutched herself with both hands. Germaine was a whore all the way through, even down to her good heart, her whore's heart, which is not really a good heart, but a lazy one, an indifferent, flaccid heart that can be touched for a moment. A heart without reference to any fixed point within, a big, flaccid whore's heart that can detach itself for a moment from its true center. However vile and circumscribed was that world which she had created for herself, nevertheless, she functioned in it superbly. And that in itself is a tonic thing. When, after we had become well acquainted, her companions would twit me, saying that I was in love with Germaine, a situation almost inconceivable to them, I would say, "Sure, sure, I'm in love with her. And what's more, I'm going to be faithful to her." A lie, of course, because I could no more think of loving Germaine than I could think of loving a spider. And if I was faithful, it was not to Germaine, but to that bushy thing she carried between her legs. Whenever I looked at another woman, I thought immediately of Germaine, of that flaming bush which she had left in my mind, and which seemed imperishable. It gave me pleasure to sit on the terrasse of the little tabac and observe her as she plied her trade, observe her as she resorted to the same grimaces, the same tricks, with others as she had with me. She's doing her job. That's how I felt about it. And it was with approbation that I regarded her transactions. Later, when I had taken up with Claude, and I saw her night after night sitting in her accustomed place, her round little buttocks chubbily ensconced in the plush settee, I felt a sort of inexpressible rebellion toward her. A whore, it seemed to me, had no right to be sitting there like a lady, waiting timidly for someone to approach, and all the while abstemiously sipping her chocolat. Germaine was a hustler. She didn't wait for you to come to her. She went out and grabbed you. I remember so well the holes in her stockings and the torn, ragged shoes. I remember, too, how she stood at the bar and, with blind, courageous defiance, threw a strong drink down her stomach and marched out again. A hustler. Perhaps it wasn't so pleasant to smell that boozy breath of hers, that breath compounded of weak coffee, cognac, aperitif, Pernod, and all the other stuff she guzzled between times, what to warm herself and what to summon up strength and courage. But the fire of it penetrated her. It glowed down there between her legs, where women ought to glow. And there was established that circuit which makes one feel the earth under his legs again. When she lay there with her legs apart and moaning, even if she did moan that way for any and everybody, it was good. It was a proper show of feeling. She didn't stare up at the ceiling with a vacant look or count the bed bugs on the wallpaper. She kept her mind on her business. She talked about the things a man wants to hear when he's climbing over a woman. Whereas Claude, well, with Claude, there was always a certain delicacy, even when she got under the sheets with you. And her delicacy offended. Who wants a delicate whore? Claude would even ask you to turn your face away when she squatted over the bidet. All wrong. A man, when he's burning up with passion, wants to see things. He wants to see everything, even how they make water. And while it's all very nice to know that a woman has a mind, literature coming from the cold corpse of a whore is the last thing to be served in bed. Germaine had the right idea. She was ignorant and lusty. She put her heart and soul into her work. She was a whore all the way through. And that was her virtue. Easter came in like a frozen hare, but it was fairly warm in bed. Today it is lovely again, and along the Champs-Élysées at twilight, it's like an outdoor seraglio, choked with dark-eyed houris. The trees are in full foliage, and of a verdure so pure, so rich, that it seems as though they were still wet and glistening with dew. From the Palais du Louvre to the Étoile is like a piece of music for the pianoforte. For 5 days I have not touched the typewriter nor looked at a book, nor have I had a single idea in my head except to go to the American Express. At 9 this morning I was there, just as the doors were being opened, and again at 1 o'clock. No news. At 4:30 I dash out of the hotel, resolved to make a last-minute stab at it. Just as I turn the corner, I brush against Walter Pack. Since he doesn't recognize me, and since I have nothing to say to him, I make no attempt to arrest him. Later, when I am stretching my legs in the Tuileries, his figure reverts to mind. He was a little stooped, pensive, with a sort of serene yet reserved smile on his face. I wonder, as I look up at this softly enameled sky, so faintly tinted, which does not bulge today with heavy rain clouds, but smiles like a piece of old china, I wonder what goes on in the mind of this man who translated the 4 thick volumes of the History of Art when he takes in this blissful cosmos with his drooping eye. Along the Champs-Élysées, ideas pouring from me like sweat. I ought to be rich enough to have a secretary to whom I could dictate as I walk, because my best thoughts always come when I am away from the machine. Walking along the Champs-Élysées, I keep thinking of my really superb health. When I say health, I mean optimism, to be truthful. Incurably optimistic. Still have 1 foot in the 19th century. I'm a bit retarded, like most Americans. Carl finds it disgusting, this optimism. I have only to talk about a meal, he says, and you're radiant. It's a fact. The mere thought of a meal, another meal, rejuvenates me. A meal. That means something to go on. A few solid hours of work. An erection, possibly. I don't deny it. I have health. Good, solid animal health. The only thing that stands between me and a future is a meal. Another meal. As for Carl, he's not himself these days. He's upset. His nerves are jangled. He says he's ill, and I believe him, but I don't feel badly about it. I can't. In fact, it makes me laugh. And that offends him, of course. Everything wounds him. My laughter, my hunger, my persistence, my insouciance, everything. One day he wants to blow his brains out because he can't stand this lousy hole of a Europe anymore. And the next day, he talks of going to Arizona, where they look you square in the eye. Do it, I say. Do one thing or the other, you bastard, but don't try to cloud my healthy eye with your melancholy breath. But that's just it. In Europe, one gets used to doing nothing. You sit on your ass and whine all day. You get contaminated. You rot. Fundamentally, Carl is a snob. An aristocratic little prick who lives in a dementia precox kingdom all his own. I hate Paris, he whines. All these stupid people playing cards all day. Look at them. And the writing. What's the use of putting words together? I can be a writer without writing, can't I? What does it prove if I write a book? What do we want with books anyway? There are too many books already. My eye. But I've been all over that ground years and years ago. I've lived out my melancholy youth. I don't give a fuck anymore what's behind me or what's ahead of me. I'm healthy, incurably healthy. No sorrows, no regrets, no past, no future. The present is enough for me. Day by day, today, le bel aujourd'hui. He has 1 day a week off, Carl, and on that day he's more miserable, if you can imagine it, than on any other day of the week. Though he professes to despise food, the only way he seems to enjoy himself on his day off is to order a big spread. Perhaps he does it for my benefit, I don't know, and I don't ask. If he chooses to add martyrdom to his list of vices, let him. It's okay with me. Anyway, last Tuesday, after squandering what he had on a big spread, he steers me to the Dom, the last place in the world I would seek on my day off. But one not only gets acquiescent here, one gets supine. Standing at the Dom bar is Marlowe, soused to the ears. He's been on a bender, as he calls it, for the last 5 days. That means a continuous drunk, a peregrination from one bar to another, day and night without interruption, and finally a layoff at the American hospital. Marlowe's bony, emaciated face is nothing but a skull perforated by two deep sockets in which there are buried a pair of dead clams. His back is covered with sawdust. He has just had a little snooze in the water closet. In his coat pocket are the proofs for the next issue of his review. He was on his way to the printer with the proofs, it seems, when someone inveigled him to have a drink. He talks about it as though it happened months ago. He takes out the proofs and spreads them over the bar. They are full of coffee stains and dried spittle. He tries to read a poem which he had written in Greek, but the proofs are undecipherable. Then he decides to deliver a speech in French, but the gérant puts a stop to it. Marlowe is piqued. His one ambition is to talk a French which even the garçon will understand. Of old French, he is a master. Of the surrealists, he has made excellent translations. But to say a simple thing like, "Get the hell out of here, you old prick," that is beyond him. Nobody understands Marlowe's French, not even the whores. For that matter, it's difficult enough to understand his English when he's under the weather. He blabbers and spits like a confirmed stutterer. No sequence to his phrases. "You pay." That's one thing he manages to get out clearly. Even if he is fried to the hat, some fine preservative instinct always warns Marlowe when it is time to act. If there is any doubt in his mind as to how the drinks are going to be paid, he will be sure to put on a stunt. The usual one is to pretend that he is going blind. Carl knows all his tricks by now. And so, when Marlowe suddenly claps his hands to his temples and begins to act it out, Carl gives him a boot in the ass and says, "Come on out of it, you sap! You don't have to do that with me." Whether it is a cunning piece of revenge or not, I don't know. But at any rate, Marlowe is paying Carl back in good coin. Leaning over us confidentially, he relates in a hoarse, croaking voice a piece of gossip which he picked up in the course of his peregrinations from bar to bar. Carl looks up in amazement. He's pale under the gills. Marlowe repeats the story with variations. Each time, Carl wilts a little more.
"But that's impossible,"
he finally blurts out.
"No, it ain't," croaks Marlowe. "You're gonna lose your job. I got it straight."
Carl looks at me in despair.
"Is he shitting me, that bastard?"
he murmurs in my ear. And then aloud,
"What am I going to do now? I'll never find another job. It took me a year to land this one."
This apparently is all that Marlowe has been waiting to hear. At last, he has found someone worse off than himself.
"They be hard times," he croaks,
and his bony skull glows with a cold electric fire. Leaving the Dom, Marlowe explains between hiccups that he's got to return to San Francisco. He seems genuinely touched now by Carl's helplessness. He proposes that Carl and I take over the review during his absence.
"I can trust you, Carl," he says.
And then suddenly he gets an attack, a real one this time. He almost collapses in the gutter. We haul him to a bistro at the Boulevard Edgar Quinet and sit him down. This time he's really got it. Blinding headache that makes him squeal and grunt and rock himself to and fro like a dumb brute that's been struck by a sledgehammer. We spill a couple of Fanny Brancas down his throat, lay him out on the bench, and cover his eyes with his muffler. He lies there groaning. In a little while, we hear him snoring.
"What about his proposition?" says Carl. "Should we take it up? He says he'll give me 1,000 francs when he comes back."
"I know he won't, but what about it?"
He looks at Marlowe, sprawled out on the bench, lifts the muffler from his eyes, and puts it back again. Suddenly, a mischievous grin lights up his face.
"Listen, Joe," he says, beckoning me to move closer. "We'll take him up on it. We'll take his lousy review over, and we'll fuck him good and proper.
What do you mean by that?
Why, we'll throw out all the other contributors and fill it with our own shit. That's what.
Yeah, but what kind of shit?
Any kind. He won't be able to do anything about it. We'll fuck him good and proper. One good number, and after that the magazine will be finished. Are you game, Joe?
Grinning and chuckling, we lift Marlow to his feet and haul him to Carl's room. When we turn on the lights, there's a woman in the bed, waiting for Carl.
I forgot all about her, says Carl.
We turn the cunt loose and shove Marlow into bed. In a minute or so, there's a knock at the door. It's Van Norden. He's all a flutter. Lost a plate of false teeth at the Balneig, he thinks. Anyway, we get to bed, the four of us. Marlow stinks like a smoked fish. In the morning, Marlow and Van Norden leave to search for the false teeth. Marlow is blubbering. He imagines they are his teeth. It is my last dinner at the dramatist's home. They have just rented a new piano, a concert grand. I meet Sylvester coming out of the florist's with a rubber plant in his arms. He asks me if I would carry it for him while he goes for the cigars. One by one, I've fucked myself out of all those free meals which I had planned so carefully. One by one, the husbands turn against me, or the wives. As I walk along with the rubber plant in my arms, I think of that night a few months back when the idea first occurred to me. I was sitting on a bench near the coupole, fingering the wedding ring which I had tried to pawn off on a garçon at the Dôme. He had offered me 6 francs for it, and I was in a rage about it. But the belly was getting the upper hand. Ever since I left Mona, I had worn the ring on my pinky. It was so much a part of me that it had never occurred to me to sell it. It was one of those orange blossom affairs in white gold, worth $1.50 once, maybe more. For 3 years, we went along without a wedding ring. And then one day, when I was going to the pier to meet Mona, I happened to pass a jewelry window on Maiden Lane, and the whole window was stuffed with wedding rings. When I got to the pier, Mona was not to be seen. I waited for the last passenger to descend the gangplank, but no Mona. Finally, I asked to be shown the passenger list. Her name was not on it. I slipped the wedding ring on my pinky, and there it stayed. Once I left it in a public bath, but then I got it back again. One of the orange blossoms had fallen off. Anyway, I was sitting there on the bench with my head down twiddling the ring when suddenly someone clapped me on the back. To make it brief, I got a meal and a few francs besides. And then it occurred to me, like a flash, that no one would refuse a man a meal if only he had the courage to demand it. I went immediately to a cafe and wrote 12 letters. Would you let me have dinner with you once a week? Tell me what day is most convenient for you. It worked like a charm. I was not only fed, I was feasted. Every night I went home drunk. They couldn't do enough for me, these generous once-a-week souls. What happened to me between times was none of their affair. Now and then, the thoughtful ones presented me with cigarettes or a little pin money. They were all obviously relieved when they realized that they would see me only once a week. And they were still more relieved when I said, it won't be necessary anymore. They never asked why. They congratulated me, and that was all. Often the reason was I had found a better host. I could afford to scratch off the ones who were a pain in the ass, but that thought never occurred to them. Finally, I had a steady, solid program, a fixed schedule. On Tuesdays, I knew it would be this kind of a meal, and on Fridays, that kind. Kronstadt, I knew, would have champagne for me and homemade apple pie. And Carl would invite me out, take me to a different restaurant each time, order rare wines.